Another endearingly shambolic podcast from WeDigPodcasts.com.
Hi, we dig music, and because of this we've kept the music in our podcast at a low background level because we believe that you should support the artists by buying their records and going to their gigs. If you want to hear the songs in full, we've made Spotify playlists of all available music featured in each episode, which you can find on WeDigPodcasts.com. You can also join in the discussion on Facebook and Twitter by searching at WeDigMusicPcast. Finally, if you dig what you're hearing, please subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice, write a review if possible, and tell all your friends that you think would enjoy it. Anyway, enough of my yakking. On with the podcast. Hello, welcome to We Dig Music. I'm Colin, and with me as usual are my comrades and co-hosts, Ian.
Hello.
And Tracy.
Hello.
This episode, we are at the letter J.
We are. All of us.
All three of us. We have arrived at our destination of...
Okay, then. Jolin.
Didn't mean that our names have
Tracy.
Changed. Tracy sounds pretty good.
It does, doesn't it?
I like that. Yeah, we'll use that.
Well, that technically means I'm Jan, which means I'm named after my aunt, which is not suboptimal, this.
So, the bands that we're talking about that begin with the letter J are Yezu.
Yep.
And Joy Division.
Joy Division.
Joy Division. Jezu and Joy Division. Ian, I think you're going to tell us about Yezu or Jezu or Jezu.
Yes, I am.
Go for it.
Okay. Wikipedia grammar is correct. Yezu is a British experimental band.
It's because it's one person.
Yes, for the most part.
Well, yeah.
Recorded, yes. Formed in 2003 by Justin Broderick.
Justin
Broderick. Following his 2002 breakup of the band Godflesh.
That is, of course, extreme music legend Justin K. Broderick.
Yes, it is. Mm. It is named after the last song on Hymns, the final album of Godflesh's initial run. So there.
It is.
Yezu's sound is heavily layered and textured, incorporating a diverse mix of influences.
It's basically post-metal shoegaze.
Yeah, basically.
Very good post-metal shoegaze.
Apparently Broderick, he's described it himself as, it's a very loosely speaking pop rock metal electronica. I'm intentionally writing what I consider to be coherent pop songs.
Yes.
It kind of is. They're just very slow.
Yeah, it's his own interpretation of pop songs.
Yes, yes.
We're not quite talking Little Mix.
Not
that'd
exactly.
That'd be amazing.
Yeah.
If you went from Napalm Death to Head of David to Godflesh to Little Mix.
Well, you know... I've forgotten his name. Dude from Botch went to Minus the Bear.
Yeah,
that's quite a leap.
It is quite a leap,
a conceptual
but it's not
leap.
Quite smash hits pop chart music, is it?
I guess not.
But Justin's done a bit of everything, really.
He has.
He's a Birmingham legend.
He is.
As we quite often like to talk about. started off in, well, his first major success, if you call it major success, was he was in Napalm Death.
Yes, for like a hot minute.
Side A.
The absolutely amazing Scum album, which is basically where grindcore began.
Is it Lee Dorian on side B?
Lee Dorian's on side B, yes.
Yeah, he joined after Justin left.
You've basically got the drummer, who I've completely fucking blanked on his name. He's
Mick.
On both sides. Mick. Mick Harris?
Yes, that's the one.
Mick Harris is on both sides.
Yep.
But he's the only constant member. And, of course, Napalm Death these days have none of the original members.
No.
At all.
But, I mean, Broderick said he'd had enough of Napalm Death very quickly and left after just one side of an album.
One side of an album with very, very short songs. The album's about half an hour long, so that's about 15 minutes that he recorded in the band. Mm.
That's crazy.
And then we say he was in...
Yeah, you have got songs longer than that.
A lot
much
of songs
longer
than that.
I mean, we say he was in Head of David, but he was only there really very briefly. He said he was literally there for about 6 weeks. He did a Peel session, which he said was a highlight of his life. And he'd been starting to write some more songs for the band, but then they had some artistic differences and he was kicked out in 88. So, yeah.
And it sort of interestingly cyclical, because Head of David influenced Fear Factory, who covered Dog Day Sunrise on D-Manufacture, and then Yaesu, in some of the sort of vocal bits, kind of remind me of the big poppy choruses in Fear Factory.
Yeah.
So I think there's been a bit of influence in each other going on there.
Well, it would be hard not to. It'd be hard not to cross paths.
Exactly.
I never realised, while I was researching for this, that Rob Hampson... late 80s psych drone band Loop was briefly in Godflesh. He was in Godflesh from 91 to 92, and I never knew that.
Did you also read that the incredibly legendary Ted Parsons of Swans and Prong was in Yaesu?
No.
Yes, I did.
I've seen them with him. I've seen Prong with him as well.
Yeah.
And Swans.
But then Broderick's also a producer. He's produced Pantera, Isis, Mogwai. Pelican.
He's remixed them. Remixed. Yeah, he's definitely never produced Mogwai, and I don't think he's ever produced Pantera. That was mostly Terry Date.
But he was on the same. He's on the same label as Pelican, though, wasn't he?
Hydrahead.
Yeah.
Which is Aaron from Isis's label.
Yes.
Right.
Yep.
And I mean, the thing with, I mean, I was talking about the pop bit, saying he's got a weird sense of pop, but actually, Yaesu's really early stuff in the 80s was really synth pop when Alison Moyo was on vocals, when it was pronounced slightly differently as
Shut
Yaesu.
Up, Colin. Shut up, Colin. How long have you been planning that one for?
That is the first thing I have written down on my page.
Fucking tit.
Yaesu are ace. Basically, really long, sort of heavy, shoegazy type songs with a massive melodies on them.
But with kind of like more of a stark post-rock soundscape behind the vocals.
Yeah.
I can dig that. Just utterly beautiful.
I've seen them live once. I think I mentioned this in an earlier episode. But it was at All Tomorrow's Parties. And I was so tired that I fell asleep within about... probably half of the first song, and then had to go back to the chalet. And I was, up until recently, I thought this was because they were on at about 2 o'clock in the morning.
No, it's because they're really, really...
No, it's not. Well, they weren't.
Slow and heavy.
I looked up the set times the other day and they were on at 11:15.
So it was just... Because it's a thing. It's an achievement to watch them live because they are fucking loud.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the guitars are just sludge.
But they're loud and not... It's loud but not uncomfortably loud Dinosaur Jr. Mainly because they haven't got the really piercing treble.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, but good guitar sounds.
It was in Butlin's, and I'd managed to get a seat with the table.
Yeah.
I was sort of leaning on the table and nodding off, and
I've been to a few gigs where I've been asleep. And yeah. Still, you know that state where you're asleep but you're still able to listen to things?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a Reading Festival years ago where I managed to find the most comfortable area of the entire Reading site. Was this grass bit just behind the mixing desk in the Radio 1 stage.
Yeah.
And I managed to sleep through, I think it was 3 sets, but was lying there listening the whole time. And it was like Polyphonic Spree, Interpol and The Rapture.
Right.
Yeah, this year's...
probably best sleeping through Interpol.
I slept through the entire of Daleks set at Hellfest this year. Which is disappointing, because I wanted to see them.
I think I saw a bit of Dalek the same year at ATP, unless it was at... I've either seen them at ATP or at one of the Supersonic festivals.
Yeah, I saw the front man of Dalek doing more straight hip-hop at Supersonic.
Yeah.
I slept through part of Primal Scream's Screaming Anarcho for 25 years.
Where was that?
In Manchester. I was knackered.
I think I could have done that, but it's not through tiredness.
I didn't sleep through, but I missed a Head of David set in Reading 89 because I was queuing for the toilets.
So easily done at Reading.
So it wasn't a very long set, but it was a very long queue. I could hear them, though, because everything's kind of in the same field.
Yeah.
So
I would imagine they were pretty fucking loud as well.
Yeah, they were.
So, I was quite surprised because Yaesu are a band that I've not really massively picked up on until we started doing this. And I know I should like them. Loved Godflesh.
Yeah.
I used to listen to their Songs of Love and Hate album a lot. And then the more sort of pop, you know, if you put that kind of thing but add loads of pop melodies and post-rock things, that's totally my kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I don't know why I've not particularly listened to them before. Possibly because my first real knowledge of them was when I went to see them and fell asleep. And I've thought then, perhaps they're not that good then.
I was very excited by them.
Yeah.
Also, it's a surprise that you didn't end up coming to see Mono with us.
Yeah.
When we all went over and they supported them. And then I think it was just the Structures guys like me, Ian and Andy went over.
Yeah.
And saw Yaesu headlining. Supported by Iroha, who are a band that sound basically exactly like them.
Okay.
But not as good.
See, I wasn't so into Godflesh, really. I think it's fair to say I prefer the experimental electronica of Yaesu. But I wasn't really aware of him until he did the collaboration with Sunkill Moon.
Oh, well, that's what I was about to get onto, because I'm a massive Mark Kozelek fan.
Yeah.
Red House Painters particularly. But I didn't like the collaboration. I've not heard the second one, but the first
one. No, I haven't listened to the second one.
Because the second one isn't on Spotify. But the first one, it was too wordy.
It's just Kozelek just babbling.
It is. And
some boxing match he saw on telly last night.
It's like he needs an editor.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, I saw... Justin actually came and played with him. I saw Kozelek at the Glee Club a couple of years ago.
Okay.
In Birmingham. And Justin guested on a couple of tracks.
That's pretty cool.
Awesome to see him. Awesome. And but then even
did
then
it
I didn't
suddenly get way louder when he came.
It did actually. and Kozelek all of a sudden got much more comfortable on stage with Justin next to him as well, which was really nice.
Was he solo before that?
Yeah.
Right. Okay, that makes sense.
So he's chilled out a lot actually in recent years. I've got to say.
No shouting at people for taking photos.
Exactly, Or heckling. I've never dared heckle him.
No, you'd have to be pretty fucking brave.
Yeah, but even then I hadn't really gone and listened to any of Yaesu's actual stuff, and I'm really surprised because I listened to the stuff that you put on the playlist, and oh my God, it's beautiful. And Justin's voice is really, really, almost swoony.
Yes, I know.
It's...
This is the season of Ian being right about things.
I know.
Like, how... I think we're every other episode, I'll just present a band that Tracy's never heard of before, and she's like, oh, my God, I love this. I know you would.
So she'll pay you back with more indie folk that you hate.
Yeah, I will.
In fact, I listened to all of Pale Sketches.
It's a very unforgiving relationship, Az, isn't it?
Sorry.
Here's these things that you love. Here's these things that you hate. Thanks.
I'll try and find something you love. I listened to all of Pale Sketches, their most recent album, last night. And yeah, it's really, really good. In fact, some of the keyboards and vocals reminded me a lot of Avrocar, who were a 2000s Birmingham electronica band. And I'm supposed to be in a band with singer-guitarist. We haven't quite got it off the ground yet. We will.
How many years has that been? Because I'm sure you've been saying that for about 10 years.
18 months.
Okay, fair enough.
It's been about 18 months since we tried to start it, and we haven't. But my God, I mean, so it reminded me of that, and I think, God, if we could sign anything like that, I'd be ecstatic.
So do it.
Yeah, I really should. And I bought new equipment and everything, and I just haven't had a chance to play with it. This really inspired me.
Did you ever listen to anything on... I don't think it was on the playlist. Did you listen to anything outside of that? Because there's an album called Every Day I Get Close to the Light from which I came.
No, I didn't listen to that because I listened to all of the Pale Sketches instead.
Okay, you will love that album.
Okay.
It's probably the most melodic Yaesu album, I reckon.
Yeah, I thought I put a track from that on the playlist.
May have done, actually.
From which album?
Had it got Homesick or Comforter on the
no.
playlist?
No, it wasn't.
Okay, because they're the first two tracks on there that you would absolutely love.
I even liked that 49-minute track that you put on, Infinity. Yeah.
Which is a lie. It's only 49 minutes. That is considerably less than Infinity.
Less than Infinity.
It is, like,
but
unless the vinyl version has got a lot groove at the end.
Maybe.
But I liked the way things came and went. You know, the vocals came and went, and sometimes they were quite soft, sometimes quite hardcore. some really, soft bits, some drony bits, a bit of brutal kick drum somewhere in the middle, and I really liked it. It was just this whole movement,
like a
symphony.
The drum programming on some of the tracks I thought was a little bit half-assed. Some of the drum programming sounds like what you'd put in as a guide track, or what I put in as a guide track, and then come back to later on, because Godflesh had such really awesome stuff with it. There was a lot of dub influence in Godflesh. So they used loads of delays on the drum machine to thicken it up. And because he's not doing that, because it's a totally different sort of direction, I think I miss it in there. Yeah.
There was a bit in Infinity, actually, that made me think of Structures. There was a part when the...
Have we found more things Ian's ripped off?
Possibly.
Not knowingly, although I definitely heard that.
Sort of around the seven-minute mark, when the vocals and the drums drop away, and then it gets really quiet and then starts building up again, it just made me think of Structures.
Bad things to be compared to.
No, I think unconscious influence is what I'm going to call that one.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, definitely not deliberate. But, yeah, man.
Awesome.
I like Yaesu a lot.
They are good. Battle of My Split was really good as well.
Yes.
Because that meant I didn't know it existed. And there were two Battle of Mice tracks I had never heard.
Which is good.
Yeah. Because Battle of Mice are fucking phenomenal.
Yes. That album is just heart-wrenching.
Yeah.
Oh.
We've mentioned it before.
Yes.
We may end up at some point doing an episode, but they've only got one album.
Yeah, so we just do the episode on the album.
Yeah.
I think pretty much.
And those two tracks.
Yes. Which I'm guessing they recorded before the album.
Probably, yeah, because they hated each other throughout the recording, so I can't imagine them going back and doing more. We've now run out of all the stories about Battle of Mice.
Yes.
So probably can't do that as an episode.
No, basically,
they all hated each other because Julie Christmas was in a relationship with the guitarist, and they split up.
Yep. yeah.
Basically like an extreme metal Fleetwood Mac.
Justin Broderick. Justin Broderick is part of the catalyst for my favourite ISIS-related on-stage moment as well.
Is it? Can we just clarify to people listening? ISIS the band, yes.
Not ISIS the dog.
Not ISIS the dog, yes.
I saw JK Flesh supporting ISIS the band.
Which is his
solo
electronic project.
Stuff. Or it might have been Final, I'm not sure, but either of those are his electronic... And there was these two fucking dicks in front of me, and they talked all the way through his set, and then all the way through ISIS's set. So obviously, they just wanted to hear some old stuff.
Right.
And it kind of built and built, and they kept shouting for these old tracks, and then you got Aaron Turner just goes, "This is an old one. It's for everyone in the room except these two fucks at the front that keep shouting for it. Fuck you guys." They were both like, "Oh."
But Broadrick's so prolific, though. I mean, especially recently, because I mean, there's J.K. Flesh. They had an album in 2016 and one in 2018. Godflesh had another album in 2017.
Yep.
Yezu have released one this year. I mean, the guy doesn't stop.
No. Well, I guess when you're like at that kind of level, you can't.
Yeah.
You're like a shark at that point. If you stop, you die.
It's like, what, 34 years, I think, that he's been going for?
Yeah. It's probably just what he does now.
Yeah. Sort of really, when I was doing a bit of research on like the early Napalm Death stuff, there's a really good documentary about the making of Scum. On YouTube, and there's a bit on it where they're in Mick Harris's mom and dad's house.
Yeah,
where they basically the early days, there was a bit where they were teaching Justin the songs, and it was just the two of them in his bedroom.
Yeah,
And it's looking out the window, and it's a house in Kings Norton in Birmingham.
Awesome.
I recognise a couple of things in the background. I think it's about three roads round from where my sister used to live.
That's
not at the time. Obviously.
Yeah, yeah. Because, was she even born?
Yes, she would have been two.
So probably not living on her own at
that
point.
So no, that would have been very weird. Social services would probably have had to get involved.
Mm.
Justin Broderick's favourite Yezu album is Conqueror.
Yeah,
That's the one with Weightless and Horizontal on it.
Yeah,
it's a good one.
And there's a track called Stanlow on there. That's really
I think that well. Song actually, Weightless and Horizontal, sounds quite Cure-like.
There's definitely Cure influences.
Oh yeah, 100%, 100%
through all of it.
I could die listening to that song, to be honest.
Please don't. We've got a lot more episodes planned.
It was just quite heartbreaking. It's a really, really beautiful sound.
Mm.
But yeah, every day I get close to the light from which I came, you need to check out.
Okay.
Cool.
Yeah, I think we're
about done now.
I think
we are.
Which
is unusual for us at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. So we like Yezu. You should all listen to it.
Yes.
We really do.
Boom. I think we should probably talk about Joy Division.
Yes, indeed. Joy Division.
Were an English post-punk band formed in 1976 in Salford. They consisted of Ian Curtis on vocals and guitar, Bernard Sumner, guitar and keyboards, Peter Hook on bass, and Stephen Morris on drums. Originally called Stiff Kittens and then Warsaw, Sumner and Hook formed the band after seeing the Sex Pistols at the Free Trade Hall in Manchester.
The first time that they played. They went twice.
One of the several thousand people who swore they were there.
The seminal gig was the first gig there. There were about probably 20 people there, and among those people, most of them ended up forming bands.
Yeah.
Now, I was thinking of a sort of philosophical question earlier about this.
Go on then.
So the people that were present at that gig.
You'd
got. Obviously, Peter Hook and Bernard Sumner. You'd got Tony Wilson, who formed Factory Records.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You'd got most of the Buzzcocks. Well, you got all of the Buzzcocks because they were the support band.
Shane McGowan?
I don't think so.
The second one, then?
So he was at the second one. Okay. He definitely wasn't at the first one. I'd know. I would have seen him because I was at the first one, obviously.
Of course.
John the Postman.
Yeah.
was just a local Manchester character, and Mick Hucknall from Simply Red. So, with all of the excellent music that came out of that gig, is it worth going back in time and bombing the building, killing everyone involved, just so that we don't get Simply Red?
No.
Okay. No. No. On balance, no.
No, like, as much as I dislike him, no. Plus,
fair enough. Right, just an idea.
If he hadn't formed Simply Red, he wouldn't have tried to hook up with Martine McCutcheon, and she wouldn't have thrown up in his hair, leading to him cutting his dreads off.
That is a fair point. That is a fair point.
So, I didn't know that.
Yep. Yeah, yeah. He is predatory, very predatory.
As a ginger person, I feel that he has done more damage to us than anything else.
The sun.
I'm sure. the sun's done a fair bit. Yeah, fair point. Fair point. But I'm sure that most of the reason people hate ginger people is because of Mick Hucknall.
Yeah, yeah. He's been holding you back for years.
But anyway, at that gig were Peter Hook and Bernard Sumner,
yep.
Who then formed Stiff Kittens, because they suddenly got punk. Before that, they
suddenly got punk, like it's some kind of disease.
Yeah. No, before that, they had scooters with Santana stickers on.
Oh my! That's a really
confusing
fucking metaphor, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
We like dressing sharply and listening to Latin music. What the? No, what? I don't think Paul Weller would approve. I don't think Santana would approve either.
I think generally we should do everything that Paul Weller doesn't approve of.
Oh, 100%. Like, Paul Weller can fuck off with his stupid hair.
Yeah.
Anyway, to complete my introduction.
Stupidity.
Go on.
So, Joy Division had three studio albums. The third one was a compilation of unreleased.
This is your pick, Tracy.
I know. And their final live gig. But the band came to
I could edit that for you, but I'm not going
to. Don't bother. The band came, unfortunately, to a southern end in 1980 when Curtis committed suicide on the eve of their first US tour.
Literally the day before.
Yes, the night before. And the remaining members, together with Gillian Gilbert, formed New Order from the ashes of the band.
Stephen Morris, the drummer's girlfriend.
Ooh, yes.
That's not a good idea. That's never a good idea.
I fucking love Joy Division. I had a massive, massive Joy Division obsession years ago. Not as much these days as there was, but late 90s.
Yeah.
They are one of the bands that I suddenly discovered.
Is it because you were super fucking miserable in the 90s?
Fair bit. That was what I would describe as my goth days.
Mm-hmm.
I basically discovered them through other bands covering them.
Yeah, yeah.
So you'd got Therapy covered Isolation,
which is a great version.
It's which is on their Troublegum album.
It is.
And Nine Inch Nails did Dead Souls on the Crow soundtrack.
Yes, also a great version.
So I'd heard both of these songs and knew they were by Joy Division. Obviously, I'd heard Transmission and Love Will Tear Us Apart.
Yeah, yeah.
So I went into a music shop in Tamworth, and they'd got the Substance compilation in the sale. So I got it for about $3.99, I think.
Oh, that's good.
And it had got it hadn't got Isolation on there, but it had got all the other tracks that I knew. Bought it, and it was fucking brilliant. And I remember, at the time, me and Ian used to DJ on a Monday night at the Jailhouse in Tamworth.
Ah, yes.
Where there were nobody in. There was basically me, Ian, a couple of other people. Quite often we were DJing. There were three DJs, me, you and Gumby.
Mm-hmm.
And Gumby's brother, Tim.
Yep.
And that was the entire people we were DJing to. So it was basically just playing free pool and playing whatever the hell we wanted to listen to on a big PA system.
Yeah, yeah. Living the dream,
good.
Man.
But I remember playing Dead Souls. Going, Ian, check this out. Check it out, man. It's that one that Nine Inch Nails covered. And you absolutely fucking hated it.
Yeah.
Because you didn't like the vocals.
No. No, he's still a bit Marmite-y, isn't he? I've softened more towards it now. But
I prefer his vocals to Bernard Sumner's in New Order. I think I mean, it may be that I've just got used to in Curtis's voice, because he's part of the problem is they never change the keys to fit his voice at any point. And Peter Hook said that a lot of the time some of the songs that they wrote were just in the wrong key for his voice.
Yeah.
So he was sort of stretching a bit to get the notes, and you can tell. But he still sounds less amateurish than Bernard Sumner does in a lot of New Order stuff.
I don't think he sounds amateur. I mean, he's not technically a good singer, but his vocals are always heartfelt.
They're not anywhere near as emotional as Curtis's.
No, well, absolutely.
No, but...
There's no emotion in most of New Order stuff at all.
But talking of cover versions and introductions to them, I have to confess... The first time I heard Love Will Tear Us Apart was actually a cover version on Paul Young's 1983 debut album, No Parley.
Wow.
Which, if you want to hear that, that album is in every fucking charity shop record bin in the world.
There's actually an account on Twitter dedicated to buying up all of them copies. And he just tweets
and
every time.
Them.
Well, I know, but I think he likes it. But yeah, so I heard that version before I ever heard Joy Division's. That was my introduction to Joy Division.
Fucking hell.
I know. It's a terrible cover as well.
You've lost your credibility now.
Swans did an alright cover of it. It's not amazing though.
They did. No, I like that cover actually.
His
voice really suits.
It's alright, but at the point, my knowledge of Swans was from their really early, really fucking brutal stuff. And then I heard that and was like, what? Because I'd heard that, Swans have done a cover of Joy Division. That's going to be fucking amazing.
No, Jira's voice really suits that song though.
Yeah, it's so tame compared to what I was expecting it would be.
True. But the weird thing with me, actually, I mean, you said about getting into Joy Division in what was known about your goth, not known as your goth days,
yeah.
So Joy Division, they're a post-punk band, yeah.
Yes.
But they've always had a huge goth following.
Well, because they're so fucking miserable.
Well, if you think about it, goth is post-punk, is where it...
Yeah.
There's that as well.
True. Do you know, the thing about Ian Curtis being really depressing and miserable is something of a myth. Tony Wilson said he was actually
he did
a
kill
lot...
himself.
he had a lot of issues in his life, but Tony Wilson said he was a lot of fun to be around. He was a cheerful, joking kind of person, but much of the miserable image of Ian Curtis was created by the photographer, Kevin Cummins, who did much of the early band photos and only released the ones where he looked really miserable.
Right, see, that's not what Peter Hook says. So I've just been reading the Peter Hook Joy Division book this week.
Yeah.
If you ask me to believe something Tony Wilson said over something Hookie said, guess whose side I'm on?
Yes, look, who spent more time with him? Peter Hook's take on it is he saw this fun, jokey side the whole time.
Mm.
And they didn't realise that he was depressed until after he died.
He didn't realise he had epilepsy until
Just under a year before he died.
I mean, he wrote She's Lost Control about a girl with epilepsy before he'd been diagnosed with it himself.
Only, yeah, it was only just that.
Right.
Was, it was quite close to the time. But, so, the way he's portrayed in this book by Hookie is that he had different sort of personalities for different people that he was with. He was a totally different person when he was with his wife, totally different person when he was with his mistress, but totally different person with the band, and then totally different person with people he worked with. And he basically hid from the band how bad he was getting with his mental health, with his epilepsy, and with everything. He got everything sort of piling up on top of him, and more and more stress. But he'd have an epileptic fit, and the band would be like, we've got to get you to hospital, we're going to have to cancel these gigs, and he'd be like, no, I'm fine, because he knew that he wanted the band to get on and carry on doing stuff. And like Peter Hook says, one of the things that they should have titled the book was, he said he was all right, so we carried on.
They went on and did a gig on a day that he tried to take an overdose.
The overdose... No, he successfully took an overdose and was in hospital, but they were gigging within a couple of days afterwards. They didn't take much time off. But it was...
Well, again, it depends whether you believe what Tony Wilson said. It was the one with the...
Tony Wilson, who famously said, if you've got the truth or the legend, print the legend.
The legend.
There you go. Whereas Peter Hook has got diaries and he documented pretty much everything in his book. He's got timelines and he's got, like, ticket stubs and stuff in there.
Yeah.
Well, the gig, the Derby Hall gig, where there was a riot, apparently.
Yeah.
They only played a short set because of Curtis's fragile state of mind.
They've had a few.
And the riot started, actually, because someone threw a bottle at a certain ratio who came back on afterwards.
Was that Derby or was that the... I thought that was in London.
Derby Hall.
Okay. Ah, Derby Hall, not actually in Derby.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Was that... Because that may have been the... There was a gig where they were supporting the Stranglers, but Hugh Cornwell was arrested for heroin possession the day before the gig. So the Stranglers played, but with various different singers.
Yeah.
And Joy Division went on, but the crowd were being really fucking rowdy. I've just read the book this week, so it's all a bit of a blur of which one's which.
Mm.
But there were a lot of gigs where they had loads of trouble with the crowd, and it may have been that one where they let a couple of kids in who then went to the back door and let, like, an extra 200 of their mates in, so it was massively over capacity. Which is something that me and Ian used to do.
Not a couple of hundred.
No, though. Not quite a couple of hundred, but you couldn't fit a couple of hundred.
Yeah, it would definitely be a good 20.
Tamworth Arts Centre, and the gigs used to get sold out, so we'd go and open the back door and let a load of extra people in there.
Excellent.
So it could have been the same thing, you know?
Could have been. We're never riots, though.
No. No, not. There probably should have been with some of the bands we were playing with occasionally.
Yeah.
But the weird thing about Joy Division is that I do love them. I really love them. But early on, quite early on, sort of 1989-ish, I'd kind of dismissed them a little because other people I knew were so obsessed with them.
So you just reacted against
it. I kind of dug my heels in a bit. And also I didn't feel like they could be my band because I wasn't obsessed enough or something. I was kind of like that with the Sisters as well, to a certain degree.
Okay.
It's like I wasn't a proper goth or something. I don't know. Probably wasn't a proper goth because I also liked Gene Loves Jezebel. I don't know.
They were their first two gigs... So the first gig was supporting the Buzzcocks and Penetration, and then their second gig was supporting Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers, which is pretty fucking impressive.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah.
It's because back then they just weren't... They were at the vanguard of... They were the first few punk bands in Manchester.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And because they got quite a good punk scene in Manchester, basically you got London... then a big gap, then Manchester. I don't think there was much of a punk scene in Birmingham because we were a metal town.
Because, of course, before Tony Wilson created the Factory label, he had a club night.
The Factory Club.
Yeah, the Russell Club with Alan Erasmus. And, so he'd have Joy Division playing there. And this was just before he started the... Yeah.
Yeah. But then, it was like a sort of do-it-yourself scene. So they were bringing... the bands were touring, and they were saying, look, we've got, you know, there are people that will come to your gig here. It was not quite often the bands putting gigs on themselves. It was nearly always the Buzzcocks arranging stuff. So the Buzzcocks were nearly always like the main support.
Well, you would be,
wouldn't
you?
Absolutely. But in the greater Manchester area, you'd got like Buzzcocks, you'd got The Fall, you got Warsaw, who later became Joy Division.
Mm. Yeah.
And John the Postman.
Stephen Morris had a choice when he joined the band. He went to saw an advert in a music shop window, and there were two adverts right next to each other.
Yeah.
And one said drummer needed for a punk band, The Fall, and the other one said drummer needed for a punk band, Stiff Kittens. And the only reason that he chose Stiff Kittens was because they had a local number, so they were slightly nearer. So he could have joined The Fall which would have been a long career, as all extra members of the four that aren't Marquis Smith have.
There was I saw a tweet only just about 5 minutes before I came over here today.
Up to the minute research.
Yeah. But no, but it's relating to a gig from about 1978, 9 or something that the Fall played. That Stephen Morris.
So he's really slow at typing.
Stephen Morris and Stephen and Julian were at. David Haslam tweeted it, and Julian saw it and went, "Oh my God, I'm in that crowd photo."
Oh,
so
cool.
It's really cool.
That's pretty awesome. Martin Hannett, we need to mention.
We do.
Do we?
Martin Hannett's the record producer.
Okay.
So the band mostly wanted to just sound like the other punk bands.
Yeah.
But Martin Hannett was Factory Records' in-house producer. So they went into the studio...
And wanted to experiment.
Martin was very, very experimental. He was obsessed with separation.
Right.
So, whereas they wanted to go into a room and just play live, basically.
Yeah.
He wanted to do things like record each of the drums separately. He used to do loads of experimenting with, like, digital delays and stuff, which was brand new technology at the time.
Yeah.
He got them into putting synths on there and taught them how to use them. But he was basically completely fucking insane.
Yeah, that thing in 24 Hour Party People where he has Stephen Morris play the drums on the roof, apparently that did happen.
Yes, well, he told him to completely dismantle the kit.
Yeah.
And then rebuild it. And he was actually, no, rebuild it on the roof and then recorded it up on the roof.
Wow.
But he also, he'd give them instructions like play faster but slower. And they were like, what? And then try and translate what the fuck you wanted, and obviously eventually get it done.
Yeah.
But it's another thing I found quite interesting was obviously after Curtis died, they then became New Order, which was the first album sounds fairly similar.
Yeah, it's basically a Joy Division album without Ian Curtis.
But then they get more and more electronic and more poppy.
Yeah.
So you'd think that's because they haven't got Ian Curtis's influence. But according to Peter Hook, it's Ian Curtis's music taste would have been closer to getting them that way anyway, because he was the one that was into all the like Kraftwerk and the experimental stuff, and you know, like stuff like Suicide. Admittedly, it probably isn't best saying that Ian Curtis was into Suicide. But yeah,
you just need to, you know, add a postscript. The band,
yes.
Suicide. The band.
The band.
When we talk about ISIS, the band,
not the dog.
Yeah,
not the dog.
Yeah. The thing I think we were originally thinking we might talk about both Joy Division and New Order, but there's so much for both of them. We'll save New Order.
Yeah, like I feel like they've got a valid enough legacy without talking about
hugely.
What came afterwards.
But it's. Even so, I think the fact it is extraordinary that the same people ended up being in two completely influential in completely different ways.
Back. Yeah, definitely.
I was trying to think of a parallel earlier, and the only one I can think of is Jefferson Airplane and Starship.
What?
No, not really.
You said about the Martin Hannett recording the drums in that way, but Will on Twitter. Now, I think we're introducing a new section of the podcast, aren't we?
We need, yes.
Willie's whinges.
Willie's.
Or something like that. He actually said...
Tracy chose that title.
I didn't. Someone else did.
Okay.
It wasn't me. He said when he listens to Joy Division, actually, he thinks the drums sound like a child's toy recorded in a concrete shed.
Yeah.
I
can get that.
The drums are interesting.
They still sound better than Husker Du.
Oh, God. That's
what prompted this, actually.
I know.
That argument rages on.
If you think Husker Du is well recorded, you're a fucking idiot. Right?
I don't think anyone disagrees with that. It's just that we don't think it takes away from what they are. But they're still good albums.
To us, definitely.
Like, yeah, because... Therapy's cover version of Diane is so much better because you can hear it. You can understand what's going on.
Oh, I can see the people getting angry over it.
I don't care. Brilliant. Like, granted, I think Therapy's cover version of Isolation is better as well. But it's not...
It's different.
It's not magnitudes better. That's the thing, because you can tell from the original that it's a good song, whereas I find it really hard to tell from Husker Du that they're good songs. Like, I don't understand how people have covered them. Like, they've gone, that song fucking rules, let's cover it.
Do you know, LCD Sound System, who we're going to be discussing later today, but it'll be much later for you lot out there.
4 weeks for everyone else.
They do a cover of No Love Lost, which was on Joy Division's debut EP, An Ideal for Living, which was only just after they'd changed the name from Warsaw, in fact.
When they recorded it, they were still Warsaw. Mm. It was between recording it and getting the artwork printed.
I think I almost prefer LCD Sound System's cover of it. They just went wild with it.
Some of their early stuff is a lot more... this is Joy Division, not LCD Sound System. Some of Joy Division's early stuff is a lot less restrained.
Yeah.
And it's... a bit less structured, some of it, isn't it?
But LCD Sound System added back in that wildness, the kind of the wire, the television influence. It was just, a stunning cover version.
Well, we'll talk about that in 4 weeks' time. There's one of the sort of most out of control Joy Division recordings I've heard. Did either of you guys have a listen to that YouTube link that I sent you the other day?
The one from Preston?
The one from Preston.
No, I didn't. I knew about it. I knew that existed as a live album.
They played a gig at Preston Warehouse in 1980. It was probably about maybe 6 weeks before
I used to go to that club every Friday night for years.
Well, everything was going wrong for them. They recorded the gig.
Yeah.
And they'd got things like every time somebody in the bar used one of the beer pumps, it was cutting out power to the guitar amp.
Fucking hell.
So you've got halfway through, or a few songs into the gig, you've got Bernard Sumner unplugging his guitar from his amp and plugging it into the second input on Hooky's bass amp. You've got various other things cutting out on stage and going wrong, things going out of tune. They've got a synth on stage that kept going out of tune.
Yeah.
And while they're trying to fix everything, you've got Ian Curtis over Mike goes, "Everything's fucking bust, so we're playing everything." No, it's Barney, sorry. "Everything's fucking bust, so we're playing everything through the bass amp." And then some woman just climbs on the stage while they're trying to fix it and lets everybody know that everybody from Burnley, the coach is leaving in 5 minutes.
Fucking hell.
And Tony Wilson loved it so much he actually made sure it was put out in the late 90s as a live album. And it's actually quite entertaining. I've played gigs like that where everything's getting wrong.
Yeah.
They're fun. When you look back at them, they're really fucking not when you're on stage at the time.
Oh, God, no.
Obviously, you can't really talk about Joy Division without talking about all of the problems that Ian Curtis had and how everything was sort of building up for him. So he started having epileptic fits well after the band had started. He used to get them on stage and they were happening even more often and more increasingly. So towards the end, it was nearly every gig he would have an epileptic fit. You get complete pricks in the audience turning up because they wanted to see that happen. Fucking trying to goad him and stuff like that because it was like the stress that had caused it. You had Rob Gretton, their manager, used to have to spend the gig in the lighting by the lighting guy to make sure if he went near a strobe light button he could immediately stop him. One of their final gigs, which was the one where they supported the Stranglers, they turned up the Stranglers had turned up late and there were loads of other problems. They didn't get a sound check. So because of that, they ended up with him not even being able to go near where the lighting guy was. Who put fucking strobes on? And the band are all playing and they're midway through a song and they're thinking these strobes have been on for ages, he's going to go in a minute, and then he did. And they've got another gig that night which I think that might be the one where there was the riot, cause yeah, on the same day, that they went to that gig, and he ended up having another one the same fucking day.
Fucking hell.
But he was married, he'd got a young 1-year-old daughter,
yeah,
which he didn't even tell the rest of the band that he had the daughter.
What the fuck?
Until she was born, which was midway through the recording of Unknown Pleasures. He was just in the studio one day and was like, oh, by the way, daughter's just been born. And they just carried on recording, basically. Because he kept
so
his, kept
weird.
All of the different aspects of his life completely separate,
yeah,
and private. He had a mistress, which was a German journalist, I think she was, called Annick Honor.
Yeah, it's been fairly well documented.
Yeah,
really.
Oh yeah, it's
since.
Yeah, there's letters that he wrote to her that his wife ended up using in her book about him. Touching from a Distance, which got turned into a movie called Control.
Alright.
Which I've not seen because I hated the book.
Yeah.
Because
you haven't seen that?
I've not seen Control. I saw Joy Division, the documentary, with you.
Oh, is that the one that you said we went to the cinema together? I don't remember going, but you said I heckled.
Yes.
What did I heckle about?
Let me get onto that in a minute.
Okay.
So everything was building up. He got this mistress as well, so his wife found out. He was going through a divorce.
Yeah.
The band were getting bigger, so he was getting all the stress from that. And it was everything just fucking piling up on him. And that's why he ended up killing himself. Don't do it. It's a rubbish idea.
Yes.
Tracy, there was a documentary that came out probably about 10 years or so now, maybe longer ago than that.
And we all know, I don't have a memory.
Just called Joy Division. We went to see it at the cinema somewhere. And it starts with a bit going on about how Manchester is the second city or something like that. And you were just shouting fuck off at the screen. Which is right, absolutely.
Yeah, because it's not.
Yeah.
See, the only thing I thought I might have been heckling at is if we'd gone to see it at a cinema and they used to put the Ben and Jerry's ads on. And it used to be this whole thing about Ben and Jerry, the hippies. And I used to shout at the screen of that because they'd sold out to Unilever. So.
Yeah, but it's worth it because fish food ice cream is fucking amazing. So I'm sorry, they can do what they like.
No, I don't remember going to see that at all.
Well, you were fucking there, I remember it. It was me, you and Malice, I think, went.
Okay. So it must have been time with Odeon.
Possibly.
Could have been, but Colin's got a car.
Yeah, it was in Birmingham. We drove.
Was it?
I think so.
Oh.
Got a feeling it was somewhere like Star City.
Yeah, it seems like the kind of film that would only get like a limited release.
Yeah. But anyway.
Yes.
Oh, I found a brilliant quote from a NME interview. Obviously, I don't agree with it because I like The Fall. But it said, is it a guy called Neil Norman writing for the NME put in a review. Unlike The Fall, who make me want to go out and kick a cat, Joy Division convinced me I could spit in the face of God. I said, oh, I like that. It's a good turn of phrase.
Yes. It's very fucking pretentious wanker journalist, though, isn't it?
It is. It is. Martin Hannett, when we're talking about films, obviously, 24-Hour Party People, which is an absolutely fantastic movie. It's not just about Joy Division, it's about Tony Wilson and Factory Records, but obviously they're a very big part of it. Andy Serkis, who played
Gollum.
And Snoke in the newest Star Wars films, plays Martin Hannett.
He's brilliant.
And it got described in a review as being his strangest role.
Wow.
And then Tony Wilson was talking about it and was like, so Andy Serkis got called his strangest role when he was playing Martin Hannett. This is Andy Serkis who's played Gollum from Lord of the Rings. But then I thought about it and he's probably right.
So Steve Coogan played Tony Wilson in that. And Tony Wilson had a lot of issue with Frank Cottrell voice over that film. If you listen to the Tony Wilson commentary over the top of the film...
Okay, which I've not done.
You should, it's hilarious. He contests almost everything in it, and he'll just be ranting
is
over
that
the top.
They're printing the legend.
Yeah, and he'll be ranting, going, "This didn't happen." Especially when it comes to the blowjob in the van. This didn't fucking happen.
It's out of his book.
Is that not in the book? You know the book is a novelisation of the movie, don't you?
Oh, right, I didn't know that.
Right, no, the movie came first. It's a Frank Cottrell Boyce written movie, and then Tony Wilson wrote a novel based on the movie, which is hilarious. And the book's actually very good. I like it a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, I adore Tony Wilson, though. I really, really do.
We've not talked about Peter Hook's bass parts. Are the most important part of Joy Division and New Order. I know you're not a big Peter Hook fan, I can tell from when you said that earlier. Of the band, I think him and Curtis are the two most important members, definitely. I mean, Stephen Morris's drums are pretty good, but Bernie Sumner can fuck off most of the time.
I mean, I have huge issues with Hookie, which will not go on air, because he's rather fond of litigation.
But it would be amazing if he sued us. I mean, we can't afford it.
I was going to say, you're paying for a wedding.
Yep.
I've got a daughter to pay for. Tracy can pay for it, fine.
Well, yeah, it's Tracy that's going to libel herself.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say a word. No, but his bass parts are amazing. And actually...
And totally influential, and they're totally different to any other bass player before him.
There's still really not another band that uses the bass in quite that way, where the bass carries much more of the melody and then the guitar does just other textural stuff in the background.
There's quite a lot where people do it, but every time they do it, it sounds like New Order or Joy Division. So you can't do it the whole time, because people will just think you're ripping it off, which you are, and that absolutely... He's one of those... You know when you're doing that thing where you're like, oh, what if you could create a supergroup out of any band members? He's normally one of the bass players that I would go with.
Yeah.
He formed a band called Free Bass once because it had three bass players. That's always amused me.
Yes.
Not as good as Evil Blizzard. They've had up to 9 bassists on stage at one point.
Free Bass, from what I've heard, aren't particularly groundbreakingly musical, so they might not be as good as Evil Blizzard.
Peter Hook doesn't have a great track record in the bands he's formed since Joy Division and New Order, though. Particularly.
Well, Peter Hook and the Light is basically him doing Joy Division and New Order stuff the way...
And the court battle for that has been... Well, that got decided out of court in the end. There was Revenge. Monaco.
You really like that Monaco track,
right? I do, actually. It's a guilty pleasure.
What do you want from me?
Yeah,
isn't
it's
it?
A guilty pleasure. I do like that song.
We're going to get into this when we do New Order another time, but I've seen New Order once, and it was more recently, so Peter Hook wasn't there. And it was shit.
I think I saw New Order. Well, I was certainly at Reading 89 when they played. But
was
I
that the year the Ramones played as
no,
well?
No, that was the year before. But I don't remember seeing New Order. I don't know what... I was possibly unconscious somewhere. I don't remember seeing New Order. I don't remember seeing the Pogues.
Okay.
I missed a lot of good stuff that year.
You didn't go out drinking with Shane McGowan at some point, because that might explain it.
I might have done.
Peter Hook while they were in the early days touring around playing all these gigs, he got this van. That he was driving around, this van obviously was seen in all these locations. You got the police knocking on the door, because it turned out that where they were playing gigs was pretty much where the Yorkshire Ripper was murdering people.
Awesome.
So he was a suspect. And then obviously he could prove that he was there with the band playing, so that got dropped fairly quickly.
that's a bit of a worry, though, isn't
it? Anything else anybody particularly wants to say? I think we're pretty much done. So...
I wanted to say one thing, actually.
Okay, go on then.
Hilarious. Do you remember when we did the Father John... when we did the Father John Misty episode?
No.
And I was...
Oh, we did, yeah.
Talking about that Radcliffe and McConey interview.
Yeah.
Josh. And they were talking about...
Get well soon, Mr. Radcliffe.
Yes, definitely. That was awful news. They were talking to him about merchandise, because Father John Misty is huge on merchandise, and he does like a line in leggings and crap like that.
didn't know that.
Oh, God, yeah. And they were saying, like, they asked him, taking the piss, if they'd do Oven Gloves. And then went on to tell him about the Half Man, Half Biscuit song, Joy Division Oven Gloves. Now, Father John Misty hadn't heard about that and asked if it was, the quote is, he said, "Is that a biting screed against band merch as a kind of cynical response to the commodification of no-wave music?" And McConey went, "Well, you'd think so, but I think it's a bit more absurdist than that." And Father John Misty said, "Well, I'm glad to hear it, because any kind of didactic, hair-splitting, post-punk competing ideologies makes me want to puke."
That dude is such a bell.
I just loved that quote. So that's my final word on Joy Division.
Does anybody else think that Half Man, Half Biscuit are potentially becoming this series' Steve Albini?
There's a reason they get him mentioned a lot.
And so they should.
I've got a Bob Weston mention to drop in one of the other episodes, I think. But no Steve Albini, no, sorry.
Okay, so OK is the next episode.
K.
K.
Yeah. So we're going to be talking about Fela Kuti and Kings of Leon.
Yes.
One of whom I'm a lot more excited about than the other. Possibly all of us are. Anyway, we've been We Dig Music. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.